Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Mark Griggs, and I'm an account manager here at Canada Life and your host for this morning's webinar. Delighted to be joined by my colleague, Kim Jarvis, who many of you will know is a member of our award-winning technical support team. And this morning's webinar, we're going to look at inheritance tax planning, including how to calculate the value of the estate, some of the various exemptions and reliefs available, and of course, how you'd mitigate IHT. So before we get started, we'll just do a couple of housekeeping items to cover off. So for those of you who are listening live this morning, your CPD certificates will be made available to you hopefully within the next 24 to 48 hours. Unfortunately, we can't give CPD to those who are listening to recordings of it or via the podcast service. But talking of recordings, today's webinar will be uploaded to the archive section of our website, normally within the next 48 hours. You will see that we do have a questions facility on the screen. So if you do want to raise any questions, please do that as we go along. And if we have time, we'll try and pick up as many of those at the end if we can. And finally, you'll see there's a section for you to be able to download some handouts and copies of the slides. So please do feel free to do that as we go along as well. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Kim, who will talk you through this morning's agenda. Kim.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, everyone. My name is Kim Jarvis, as Mark said, and today we're going to talk about the introduction to IHT. So if you look at the agenda, we're just going to go the value of the estate. We're going to look at gifts with reservation. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about exemptions and reliefs, the nil rate bans, potentially exempt transfers, chargeable lifetime transfers, and then what tax is payable, when it's payable, and who actually pays it. Okay? So the first thing I want to look at is, what is inheritance tax? Everyone has probably seen this quote from Lord Jenkins, and what he said was that inheritance tax is, broadly speaking, a voluntary levy paid by those who distrust their heirs more than they dislike the HMRC, but at the time he called it the Inland Revenue. But what you can see is, over the years, the receipts that HMRC have been receiving from inheritance tax is actually rising. Now, this could be down to maybe an increased inflation, the increase in the property prices, but HIT receipts in 17-18 were actually just over 5 billion, okay? So you can see that they're actually getting a lot of money from inheritance tax, even though it's meant to be a voluntary tax. Right, so what is inheritance tax? It's actually a tax paid on the gifting of capital. Now, this can be actually when somebody dies, okay? So it can occur when somebody dies. What you've got to do is you've got to add up everything that's in their estate, and depending on who gets those assets in the estate, depends on whether those gifts are actually exempt or not. And like I said, we'll go on to talk a little bit about the exemptions and the gifts. But what you've also got to include within that estate is any lifetime gifts that were made in the previous 7 years before they died. But also, it's actually, you can pay inheritance tax on gifts made during lifetime as well. And again, we'll go on and we'll talk a little bit about them. But the first thing is, what is the value for inheritance tax purposes? Okay, so when you're looking at the value, it's actually the loss to the estate. Now, if we look at a little example, I have got a pair of vases that are sitting on my mantelpiece. Those pair of vases are worth $500,000. Fortunately, when I'm cleaning, I knock one off the mantelpiece. I'm left with one. Now, one of those vases is only worth $100,000. Now, if we look at that, and we look at that in a way of gifting, so I've got two vases, but I gift one of the vases to my daughter, okay? I'm left with a vase that's worth $100,000. My daughter now has a vase that's worth $100,000. But the loss to my estate is actually $400,000, because before I made that gift, I had $500,000 sitting in my estate. Now I've only got $100,000, okay? So, like I said, you're looking at the loss to the estate, not effectively what you're actually giving as that gift. So, it's generally the open market value if it's sold on the day, okay? If you're looking at joint property, so, for example, we have a joint house. So with joint property, they normally own it as joint tenants. So when one dies, it automatically passes to the surviving owner. Now, most houses are owned by between spouses or civil partners. So if one of those spouses dies, it automatically goes to the surviving spouse. The value is included in that deceased estate, but because it's going to a spouse, it's exempt. But what about if the house was owned by a brother, a sister? Again, you've got to remember that when one of, say, the brother dies, the value of his share will be included in his estate, but the gift won't be exempt as it's going to the sister. Now, because the sister is still living in that house as a sitting tenant, you can actually deduct, in England and Wales and Northern Ireland, you can actually deduct 10% on the value that's included in the deceased's estate. And if you're in Scotland, you can take off 4,000 is taken off the whole value before you actually calculate the deceased share. Okay, so you can see that it's not necessarily the outright cost of that house or that asset that's actually included in the estate for inheritance tax purposes. When you're looking at life policies, you're normally looking at the death benefit. You've got to remember that ISAs, yes, ISAs are exempt during lifetime, but from an inheritance tax point of view, they have to be included in the estate. And then the other thing is, if we look at bank accounts, so again, when people get elderly, they sometimes will put a child on their bank account, which means that then they don't have to go into the bank themselves. The child can go and actually sign on their behalf. But that child has put no money into that bank account. So even though when, say, the mother dies, ownership automatically passes to that child because they're an owner of that bank account, the whole value of the money that's sitting in that bank account might actually be included in the estate of the deceased mother for inheritance tax. So again, you've got to think about who's actually provided that money, where's that money come from? And then the other thing you've got to look at is gifts with reservation. Okay, so these need to be included in the estate as well. So what is a gift with a reservation? Now, it's when you gift something, but the person that you've gifted it to doesn't actually get full enjoyment of that gift. In other words, you've retained some kind of benefit for that gift. So it could be, I've gifted my house to my kid, but I've continued to live in it. I could have a painting that's hung in my wall. I've said to my daughter, okay, I want you to have this, but I haven't actually taken that painting out of my house and physically given it to my daughter. So I'm still getting an enjoyment from that. So that needs to be included in my estate for inheritance tax purposes. Okay, so if it is a gift reservation, it forms part of my estate. It doesn't matter when I die. When I die, I could die 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line. If I've had some kind of gift with a reservation in that asset, it's included in my estate. What you've got to think about is the example I had about the painting that's hanging in my house. If I then physically, say 5 years down the line, I physically take that painting off the wall, walk it round to my daughter's house, hang it up above her fireplace, then that's when the gift actually starts, because now she's getting the full enjoyment from that gift, and I've excluded myself from any benefits from that. So the 7-year point would start from there. Okay, so that's the gift reservation. If we go on, if we go on to look at exemptions. So you've got some exemptions that will apply during death and on lifetime. So if we look at them first. So you've got the spouse exemption. So if you're dealing with clients and both of them are UK domiciled, all gifts are exempt. But you've got to consider where you might have clients where one of the spouse is non-UK domiciled and the deceased one is UK domiciled. So if you've got somebody that's UK domiciled and they gift to a non-UK domiciled, it's not full spouse exemption. The gift is actually £325,000. But the non-UK domiciled spouse could actually elect to become UK domiciled for IHT purposes. Now, yes, that would mean that all the gifts would then become exempt under the spouse exemption, but you've got to remember that because they've become UK domiciled, they'll actually be liable to IHT on their worldwide assets. So that's just like something that you might have to weigh up, because you don't know what other assets they've got during the world. Charities, any gifts to charities during lifetime and on death are fully exempt. And again, if you're gifting to charities on death, if you gift more than 10% of your net estate, then you're looking at a reduced IHT, and we'll go on to that in a few slides down the line. Then you're looking at exemptions that are only available during lifetime. So each person has got an annual exemption of 3,000. Now, with the annual exemption, you can go back 1 year. So if you haven't used it in the previous year, you can bring it forward and you can use it in this year. But what you've got to remember is that if you're doing a gift this year, say I'm doing a gift of 4,000 this year, you have to use your current 3,000 annual exemption first before you can carry forward any of the previous year's 3,000. So in that instance, I would actually be losing 2,000 of my previous years. You've got 250 small gift exemptions, and these can be made to as many people as you want. But you've got to remember that it can't be combined with another exemption. So I couldn't gift one person 3,250 and think that I'm using my annual exemption on my small gift exemption. You can't do that. Then you've got marriage exemptions. So you've got to think about, you've got, each person has got two parents. They can give 5,000 each. You've got four grandparents that can give 2,500 each. And then anyone else can give 1,000. And the marriage exemption can be combined with the annual exemption. Okay, so if we look at normal expenditure out of income. So normal expenditure out of income, it's only available during lifetime. Now, with a lot of legislation, you're looking at what a reasonable person would do or what an average person would do. But with the normal expenditure out of income exemption, you're actually just tailoring it to that particular person, to the transferor. And it doesn't mean that it has to be regular. So regular, you're probably more likely to meet the test, but that person can do it seasonally if they want. It's got to be out of surplus income. So in other words, whatever you're gifting under this exemption, their standard of living can't reduce, and so it's got to be out of surplus income. You've got to remember that an investment bond is, it actually, when you're taking 5%, so you're taking money from an investment bond, that's actually a return of capital. So again, we get asked this quite regularly, that can I take my 5% from my investment bond and gift that using normal expenditure? And the answer is unfortunately no to that, because like I said, it's capital. And the other question we get asked quite a bit is, okay, so can I use some income and use that under the normal expenditure and then supplement my income by taking the 5% from the bond? And again, unfortunately, the answer to that is no as well. With this exemption, it's only, even though it's during lifetime, you can write to HMRC during the lifetime, but they will only look at it on death. So you've really got to keep a really good audit trail of this. So you've got to make sure you've got bank details, you're showing that they've still got enough income to live on when they're making all these gifts. Okay, so that's just one point. Just make sure you keep a really good audit trail. Then the next thing is reliefs. Now, the reliefs are given on death. And the two main reliefs are agricultural relief. So you get agricultural relief if you've owned and occupied it and you're using it for agricultural purposes. and you've been using it for 2 years before death, and the relief would be at 100%. Then you've got the business relief. Depending what it's invested in, you either get it at 50% or 100%, and again, you've got to own either the shares of the business for 2 years before death. Now, one point is that if you have an asset that qualifies for both, the agricultural relief will take priority over the business relief. Okay? So if we go on to look at the nil rate bands. Now, again, a nil rate band, it's not an allowance. It's a nil rate band and it's taxed at 0%. There's nothing to say that HMRC could turn around and say, okay, I'm now going to tax this at 10% or 20%, but at the moment it's taxed at 0%. Anything over that nil rate band is then taxed at 40%. But remember I said about the gifts to charities, and you could have them during lifetime and on death. Now, if you give 10% of your net estate to a charity on via your will, your actual IHT is reduced to 36%. Now, what is the available nil rate band? So each person has a standard nil rate band, and at the moment it's 325,000. Now, it's been 325,000 since April 2009, and it was frozen again a couple of years ago to April 2021. We don't know. We're hoping it's going to go up from April 2021. You just don't know. If it does go up, it will increase in line with CPI. You've got to note that if a deceased person has died previously, then you can actually transfer some of the nil rate band, and that's what I'll look at now. So when you transfer the nil rate band, it's not necessarily doubled, okay? Because you've got to think about when one of the spouses died, if not everything has gone automatically or been transferred to the surviving spouse, they could have used up some of their nil rate band. Now, the way it's worked out is a percentage. And the reason why it's worked out as a percentage is because then when it gets to be claimed on the second spouse's death, if the nil rate band has gone up, they will actually be entitled to whatever that's gone up with, the percentage of that. If you worked it out as a monetary value, then you wouldn't be able to get the increase, okay? A couple of things you've got to remember. There was no spouse exemption before March 72. And between 72 and 74, the spouse exemption was only 15,000. Since 74, gifts to spouses have been 100%, okay? But if you've got a client that has a spouse that has died quite a long time ago, that's just a few pointers that you've got to think about. So if you look at an example, so we've got Gordon dies May 2018. He just leaves everything to his wife. She then dies 2 years later. So on Kay's death, her personal representatives can actually claim Gordon's nil rate band. Now, because everything was transferred to Kay, then he didn't use 100% of his nil rate band, so Kay's executors can actually claim double. They can claim 200% of whatever that nil rate band is at the time that she dies. Right, so if we look at the residence nil rate band. So the residence nil rate band, it's only available on death. And again, when this came in last April, we were getting asked a lot of questions on, okay, so now for lifetime gifting, they now have 425,000, because when it was introduced, it was worth 100,000. The answer is no, you can only get it on death. So currently, the residence nil rate band is 125,000. It's going to go up each year by 25,000 until it reaches 175,000 in April 2020. The other thing you've got to think about is the value of the house. Okay, so if you're dealing with a house that's worth less than the RNRB, then it's capped at the value of the house. We're hoping, like the standard nil rate band, that from April 2021 is going to increase in line with CPI. And like the standard nil rate band, it can be transferred to a spouse, irrespective of when the first death occurred. So what I mean by that is, so if you have a client where their spouse died in 2015, they survivor now dies, they can actually claim 100% transferable R&RB, and they don't even need to have a qualifying interest. The only thing you've got to consider is the cap, and which we'll go on to in a couple of slides further on. So what you can see by that is that if the second death occurs after the 5th of April 2020, then that person may have a nil rate band of 1 million. And that is the two standard nil rate bands, which are 650, plus the two resident nil rate bands, okay? And the 1 million is what was quoted when the government's manifesto, when the Conservatives were going up for re-election. So that's where they get that 1 million from. But not everyone will actually get that. There's a lot of conditions to meet with the residence nil rate band, and you can only claim it if their actual house is passing to direct descendants. And by direct descendants, that's children. It does include stepchildren, adopted children. It can include the spouse and civil partner of those children, widows and widowers. Okay? It doesn't necessarily have to be an outright gift. It can pass via a trust. And the trusts are actually listed there. But one trust that's actually admitted, which a lot of people use, is a discretionary trust. Now, the reason why you don't get it when it passes to a discretionary trust is because the trustees have got discretion who to pay to. They may not pay it to a direct descendant. So if you've got a client where they have died and maybe their will, they have a discretionary will trust, what you've got to think about is, if the trustees actually make an appointment to a direct descendant within 2 years of death, because of the section 144 of the Inheritance Tax Act, it's actually read back to the deceased death, so they would be able to get the R&RB. So that's just one thing that they could actually consider doing. Another condition of the R&RB is you have to have a qualifying interest. Okay, so the definition is on the screen. I just want to pick up a few points from that. You've got, it says, which has been the person's residence at any time. That doesn't necessarily mean it has to be the main residence when they actually die. It just means it has to have been his main residence at some point during his lifetime. The definition also doesn't say that it's got to be in the UK. So maybe I've got a client that spends 6 months in the UK, they spend 6 months in Spain. There's no reason to say that they couldn't use the R&RB against the house in Spain. He's treating it as his main residence. The only thing you've got to think about is if he's renting that house out or he's using it as an investment property, then he wouldn't be able to get the R&RB against that. So if we just look at a few examples, we've got house owned, husband and wife, first death, automatically passes to the surviving spouse, it's exempt under the spouse exemption, so the R&RB can be transferred. If we look at another example, with the way that property prices are rising, more and more people are clubbing together, brothers, sisters are actually clubbing together and buying a house. So if you've got a house that's owned by a brother and sister, joint tenants, on the brother's death, his share will automatically pass to the sister. The gift is not exempt. It's not passing to lineal descendants, so there's no R&RB. But there has actually been recently, over the last couple of weeks, there's been a private bill proposed to allow siblings to actually form a civil partnership. And the bill at the moment is sort of it's going through the House of Lords. And it actually says that provided that both are over 30 and that they've lived together continuously for 12 years, then they might be able to actually form a civil partnership. And if they can do that, then they would get the exemption because they'd be treated like a civil partnership and they would be able to transfer the RNRB. So we're just watching that space on whether that bill is actually gets passed or not. The other thing with the residence mill rate band, you've got to think about large estates. Now, similar to other alliances, there's a threshold when the estate over that threshold will start to lose some of the entitlement to that RNRB. So where the estate is over 2 million, for every £2 over, you're going to lose a pound of the RNRB. The things that I'd like to point out is when you're arriving at that 2 million, it's the value of the estate after deducting liabilities, but it's before reliefs and exemptions. So you can't take off BPR, the agricultural relief, or any kind of special exemptions or anything. Okay. But one thing it doesn't, one thing that it doesn't include is lifetime gifting. So lifetime gifting, you don't need to take off. And we think that, well, we know the reason for that is because they're actually chargeable to IHT, so they're included elsewhere. So they're not included in the 2 million for the estate. Okay, so if you look at an estate on death, which in 2021, it will exceed 2.35 million, they'll get no RNRB. And if you're looking at it double, it's 2.7 million, they'll get no RNRB. And then we're hoping, again, just like the standard and the RNRB, this threshold will increase with CPI. Right, so we've gone to potentially exempt transfers. So potentially exempt transfers are outright gifts. They can be outright gifts to individuals, but they can also be gifts to certain types of trusts, absolute, disabled persons, bereaved minors. There's no lifetime IHT charge because you're waiting to see whether that potential to be exempt is actually fulfilled or not. So if the donor survives 7 years, that potential has been realised, they become exempt, there's no charge during lifetime and there's no charge on death. But what if they die within 7 years? Well, if we have a look at that, so if he dies within 7 years, the potential has not been realised, so it becomes chargeable, becomes a chargeable transfer. And what that means is, the amount is included in the deceased's estate and it's included in chronological order. So all chargeable transfers sit at the bottom of the estate and they'll use up the nil rate band first. Okay? Because they sit at the bottom, it totally depends on the amount of that gift, whether it's going to be chargeable or not. It can sit on the bottom and just use up some of the nil rate band. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be chargeable, but there may be less to use against the actual estate. So let's look at an example of that. Okay, so we've got Ned dies August 2018. He'd made an outright gift to his children of $300,000 in July 2015. I've assumed that he's only got one nil rate band and he's already used his annual exemption. Okay, so because he didn't survive the 7 years, the PEP becomes chargeable. Now that PEP sits on the bottom of the estate, but it uses up 300,000 of his available nil rate band. So there's no tax to pay, but it means that there's only 25,000 left of that nil rate band to use against the rest of the estate. But if we look at another example, so if we look at Ryan, exactly the same, but Ryan made an outright gift of 500,000. So that PEP becomes chargeable. Part of it will use up the nil rate band, but there's 175,000 sitting above that, which is now liable to tax. So how much tax is actually payable? How much tax will the actual donor of that gift have to pay? The first thing you've got to consider is you've got to consider the taper relief. Okay? So taper relief offers a gradual reduction in the amount of the IHT due on gifts made within a 7-year period. So there's a common misconception that taper is actually you taper the gift, but you don't. You actually taper the tax that's paid. So if there's no tax to pay, there's no taper relief. If there is tax to pay, you're entitled to taper relief. So because there was tax to pay on Ryan's gift, he is entitled to taper relief. The gift was made in July 2015. He died in August 2018, so he died between years 4 and 5, so he's entitled to taper relief. So effectively, the actual gift, or the actual tax on the gift, the liability, is $42,000. Okay, so if we look at chargeable lifetime transfers now, so we all know chargeable lifetime transfers, they're neither exempt or potentially exempt. The most common type that we've got is discretionary trust. So a transfer will be chargeable if that gift, when you add it together with all the rest of the chargeable lifetime transfers that they've made over the 7-year period, it actually exceeds the lifetime gifting nil rate band of 325. Now, another question we get asked is, because if you have a previous spouse that's died and everything was left to their survivor, a lot of people think that they now have a lifetime gifting allowance of 650, but you only can transfer the nil rate band on death. It's not available for lifetime gifting. So everyone has only got a lifetime gifting allowance of 325. If they go above that 325, then anything above that is taxed at 20%. If the donor survives for those 7 years, then it's not included in their estate. But if they die within the 7 years, then it's brought back into the estate. You're looking at IHT payable at 40%, but you will get a credit for the lifetime tax that they had to pay. So if we look at an example, okay, so we've got lifetime transfer was made August 18 for $350,000. That's $25,000 over his lifetime nil rate band. So you're looking at 20% on that. So you're looking at $5,000 tax. If he dies within 7 years, then it has to be brought back into the estate and a further 20% is payable on that. Okay, because like I said, you get an allowance for the lifetime tax that he actually paid. You've also got to consider, depending when he died, he could actually get taper relief on that as well. If you move it on and say when we hope that the nil rate band is actually gone up in value a little bit, say it's gone up to 400,000, when he died, it's 400,000. That chargeable lifetime transfer, when it's brought back into the estate, it's beneath the nil rate band, so there's no further tax to pay, but you don't get a refund for any lifetime tax that you've paid. Okay, so if we look at how inheritance tax is now payable, so what you need to do is you need to establish the value of the estate that's chargeable to IHT. So you know that we've got to include any potentially exempt transfers that didn't realise they're potentially to be exempt. In other words, they were made between years 1 and 7 before they died. You've got to think about, you've got to also include the chargeable lifetime transfers, and then you've got to look at all the value of the assets that belonged to the deceased when he actually died, okay? And that includes the gifts with reservations and all those assets as well. Then you can take off any of the exemptions, such as the assets that go to the spouse. You're entitled to take off release, the business relief, the agricultural relief, and you're left with the chargeable total on death. Then you've got to work out what available nil rate band that client has got. So you know that each person currently has got 325 standard nil rate band. If they've got a house, or even if they had a house, they've sold it, you might still be able to get the residence nil rate band up because of the downsizing provisions. You've got to think about those. Then you've got to look at, is there any transferable nil rate bands that that client is entitled to? So you work out what his available nil rate band is. You take that away from the chargeable total off the estate to see whether there's going to be an excess. And if there's an excess over that, then you're looking at 40% or 36%, again, depending whether they've made gifts to charities on that excess. You've also then got to consider, well, if you have potentially exempt transfers that have tax to pay on them, is there any taper relief available? Have you paid any previous lifetime IHT on any CLTs in that year? But don't forget who pays what. So you're looking at if somebody is UK domiciled or deemed domiciled, and that's if they've been in the UK for 15 out of 20 years now. It used to be 17, but it was reduced a couple of years ago to 15. Then you're looking at paying tax on their worldwide assets. Non-UK domiciles will only pay it on their UK assets. If a person that's received an outright gift, a potentially exempt transfer, it's that person that's liable to pay the tax on any field pets. But if they won't pay it or they can't pay it, then HMRC will go to the personal representatives to actually get money. If a chargeable lifetime transfer becomes chargeable and there's tax to pay, then if that's been into a discretionary trust, then it's the trustees that would actually pay the tax. And again, if the trustees can't pay the tax or won't pay it, then HMRC will look to the personal representatives of the estate to actually pay that. Okay, so if you look at an example, so I've just assumed that Eric has got one nil rate band here, okay? So he's made two potentially exempt transfers, then he dies, leaving an estate of 500,000. So first of all, you've got to look at the IHT payable on the estate. The first pet that was made in April 2012 is actually fully exempt because he survived 7 years. You're just looking the pet that was made in April 2014 because he didn't survive for 7 years. Then the estate is added on top of that. You're looking at a totable of 700,000. He's got one nil rate band, so his taxable estate is 375,000, giving an inheritance tax bill of 150,000, which the personal representatives would have to pay. If we just look at that in the diagram form, you've got the potentially exempt transfer, it fails, becomes chargeable, you've got the estate that sits on top, there is no tax to pay on that chargeable transfer, but it's used up some of the nil rate band, you've got a little bit of the estate that gets the remainder off the nil rate band, and then you're looking at the rest of the estate that's got taxed at 40%, which is the 150,000. So if we go on to another example, we go on to Joan. Now, Joan has made exactly the same as Eric, but the first one was a chargeable lifetime transfer she made. Then she made a potentially exempt transfer in 2014. Now, if we look at the tax payable on the estate, it's exactly the same. You've got the chargeable lifetime transfer, because she survived 7 years, it's not brought back into the estate to calculate the IHT. It's only the field transfer. So they're looking at 150,000 IHT. you might think, why am I showing you this? Okay, so you've also got to consider the tax that's payable on that field, potentially exempt transfer. And the reason or how you do that is, when you're looking at a potentially exempt transfer that's field, when you're looking at the tax that needs to be paid on that, you go back to the beginning of when that potentially exempt transfer was made. You look back 7 years to see whether there was any chargeable transfers sitting in that seven-year period. Now, with Joan, there was. She made the potentially exempt transfer in April 2014. 7 years back from there, 4 years previously, there is a chargeable lifetime transfer sitting in there. So you need to bring that back in to the calculation to work out what tax is payable on that field PET. That's over her available nil rate band. You've got the 200, the 200. So you're looking at 75,000 is over that nil rate band, meaning that the person that received that potentially exempt transfer is actually looking at an IHT bill of 18,000. So again, if we look at it on a diagram form, so the IHT on the estate between Joan and Eric is exactly the same. But because Joan made a CLT before that field PET, it has to sit underneath, which means that it brings the chargeable field PET above the nil rate band. And you're looking at, and that's where the tax actually comes from, you're looking at the tax of 18,000 on that, okay? And that's why the order of gifting is so important, to get the order right. So when is it payable? So when a death occurs, IHT is payable 6 months after the end of the month in which the death occurred. You've also got to pay any IHT bills before you can get a grant of probate. When you're looking at a field PET, you're looking 6 months after the end of the month in which the death occurred. Okay? And like I said, both must be paid before you get the grant of probate is obtained. So when you're looking at a state that's got no liquid assets, it can be quite difficult. And that's why there's a lot of people actually will take out an investment bond. They will put them in trust under a probate trust and actually then to give them the money to actually pay the probate fees. Other things they can think about is they can think about a bridging loan might need to be used. Okay, so just final summary. Really, what you need to think about, clients need to think about is, the first thing they need to think about is they want to make sure that their wills are up to date. They've also got to think about the reliefs that might be lost on first death. There's no point that if you've got assets that are entitled to business relief, that you pass them all to your spouse, because anything that you give to a spouse is exempt anyway. So you're actually not using that business relief. You might want to consider then passing it down to your kids instead. Need to make sure that they use all their exemptions that they've got during lifetime and on death. So that's the annual exemption, normal expenditure out of income, even simple things like the marriage exemptions as well, when you've got clients that have got children that get married. Think about setting up discretionary trusts, making outright gifts, that's for your pets, to absolute or outright, and then anything that's left, think about insuring. And with that, thank you, and we'll see whether there's any questions.
Thanks, Kim. A lot of great information there. Not surprisingly, we have had a couple of questions through. First one, looking at gifts out of normal expenditure, if a client has a discounted gift trust set up, is the income from that deemed to be a gift from normal income, or is it fall under the 5% rules as per a normal on bond?
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's under a life assurance or a capital redemption bond. The wrapper is a bond, and anything that comes out of that is classed as capital, so you wouldn't be able to use it. for the normal expenditure out of income.
Fantastic. And there is a second one here, Kim. Kim, we've got a house that's been gifted by parents to their children, let's say 4 years ago. So it is a gift with reservation. But they start paying market rent to the kids now. The kids also pay the rates and repairs, et cetera, at the house. So is that a transfer of value now, or would that seem to be a transfer of value 4 years ago? And so therefore, would it be outside of the estate in 3 years from today or 7 years from the original gift?
Okay, so from that, I'm assuming that they gifted it 4 years ago. There was no kind of agreement or anything. Maybe they did change the title deeds on the land register. But if the kids haven't been paying towards the upkeep of that, my opinion would be that the gift would only start when they have started to pay the rent and the kids have started to contribute to that. So I would say that the 7 years actually starts from now, not 4 years ago.
Well, I think that's, we'll leave it there for now. I'm just conscious that we don't want to overrun on time. However, before we go, just wanted to summarise some of the support. Obviously, we're aware that IHT is a big area of business for you guys. If you're not doing it on a regular basis, then support is required. So fortunately, Canada Life are here to help you on that. And we have a wide range of support, whether that's in the form of brochures and newsletters and briefing notes, whether it's things like our webinars here and our tech casts. Obviously, you do have account manager support through Canada Life as well. So if you have any questions, do go to your either field-based or telephone-based account manager in the first instance. And also, you have the team that Kim supports here today, which is the technical services team, who are always very happy to answer any questions that you might have. So I think what we'll do is we'll switch that off now. Thank you very much for everybody for attending this morning. We do value your feedback, you will see that there's a rate this section on your screen there, so any feedback that you guys would like to provide to us would be very gratefully received. But we will switch the audio off now, but we'll leave the questions open for a little while longer, so if you do have anything else, please do continue to raise those and we'll come back to you afterwards. But that's it. Thank you again for attending this morning, and we hope to see you next time. Thank you. Goodbye.